From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Joe Shaneman. It's State of Nevada. Years ago, Senator Harry Reid said he wanted to make Nevada an energy exporter, relying heavily on renewable solar to achieve that goal. Today, 13 large solar arrays in Nevada cover about 20,000 acres. The Bureau of Land Management has a new plan that would open 31 million acres of western land for potential solar, and 12 million of those are in Nevada. The federal agency expects about 700,000 of the 31 million acres to be developed by 2045, and it says it created a plan that locates those arrays close to existing rights of way and away from sensitive environments. If that's the case, why is there such fierce opposition? We begin our discussion with Attorney Frank Sturgis of the Clean Air Task Force, which supports the plan. He talked earlier this week with producer Paul Boger.
Frank, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here today.
Let's talk about the Clean Air Task Force. You know, what do you do?
So the Clean Air Task Force, we're a nonprofit that works to safeguard against the worst impacts of climate change. We're really focused on catalyzing the development and deployment of low carbon energy and other climate promoting technologies, climate protecting technologies. That's actually a big difference.
Let's talk about this news about the Western Solar Plan, opening up 31 million acres across 11 states to large scale solar operations. Talk to me, you know, what is it?
Yeah, so the Western Solar Plan is taking a look across an 11-state region in the Western United States and saying, here are the public lands that are managed by the Department of the Interior, the Bureau of Land Management. Where should these areas be available for application for these large-scale solar projects? And what should the programmatic design considerations that each of those projects have to take into consideration? What are those characteristics as well? It doesn't actually authorize any projects. It is setting out where the lands would be available for application. And then subsequent steps is when they would look at the site-specific considerations and plan those out. So it's a really key step in the process in getting solar energy deployed on public lands.
This plan is essentially an update of one that already exists. You know, talk to me, how different is this plan? Or maybe I should ask you, how different is the environment in which this plan was drafted, different from the previous one?
Congress set a goal, a clear goal, for renewable energy deployment on public lands. The administration has also set goals for that. We've seen states like Nevada set clean electricity goals. To hit those targets, we're going to need to deploy the necessary clean energy infrastructure. And the plan is updated to consider those and to help make that a reality while protecting ecosystems and communities that are going to be hosting the infrastructure we need.
You know, this is still technically a proposal. Groups can protest, they can issue statements, you know, comments about what they think should be done. But in your opinion, you know, is this a done deal?
So what BLM has done here is they finalized their environmental review. It's a proposed plan that through their planning process goes through a 30-day protest period, a 60-day governor's review before it actually becomes a part of their land use plan. So this, what it's doing is it'll ultimately amend all of the land use plans for public lands across the West. And those land use plans are a little bit like zoning. They say what can be done where, but then just like zoning, that doesn't approve any individual projects. There will then be subsequent applications. Later steps in the process still to come.
Is it just for large-scale operations, or is this any sort of solar? Is it only solar? Is it large-scale renewable projects?
The Bureau of Land Management is a multiple-use agency, and they look at a lot of different uses of public lands. In this plan, they're just looking at large-scale solar. They're not looking at other clean energy technologies, or other types of projects. So it's just setting that up and setting kind of a roadmap for what it would look like across this entire region.
Talk to me about that roadmap. You know, what should we see?
Yeah, so what they landed on is 31 million acres being open for application for projects, for these solar energy projects on public lands. It also, you know, screened for a lot of different characteristics to protect ecosystems, to protect other uses, eliminated 38 million acres from being available. So these are the acres on public lands that will be available for specific projects to apply for And then there will be further analysis each time that happens.
Overall, what kind of impact do you see this having on the solar industry here?
So we're really hopeful that it will promote smooth and quick processing of projects that will really help with addressing climate change. There are three reasons why the Bureau of Land Management wanted to update this plan. The first is that technology has changed since they last looked at it a dozen years ago. Solar technology has changed and improved. The second is they've got a lot more experience in implementing that plan. They wanted to consider that when they think about what it looks like next. And then the third is that there's been more direction from Congress and the administration. And that's what I think is really the key here. There's been a push to increase the deployment of renewable energy projects on public lands. So it was time for an update. Congress had set a goal of 25 gigawatts of wind, solar, and geothermal being permitted by 2025. As the Department of the Interior was looking at this plan, they announced they'd hit that goal. So this is really about what's next, and seeing that increase in the clean energy deployment that we need to hit the climate goals, the clean electricity goals of the country and of states like Nevada.
Your organization believes, and I'm quoting here, federal lands can play a crucial role in achieving U.S. climate targets through clean energy development and carbon storage. What does that mean?
What that means is that if you look at the landscape of public lands and the mitigation potential that's there to deploy solar, to deploy wind, to deploy geothermal energy, this is going to help us hit those clean electricity goals. And we can also think about managing them for ecosystem-based carbon storage, for instance, long-term carbon storage and ecosystems. So you want to have resilient ecosystems that are going to store and keep that carbon. And you also want to think about how can we use this land, this resource, to deploy it to mitigate climate change through getting renewable energy, clean energy infrastructure deployed.
Environmentalists, though, across Nevada have had a number of concerns about this plan, especially considering that much of it in Nevada opens up land that is undisturbed and is in sage grouse habitat, desert tortoise habitat. Have you looked into those sorts of concerns at all?
So I'll give a couple points about that. So the first is that what does the plan do here, right? So it's 31 million acres being available, and the Bureau of Land Management screened for two, well, really three different things. The first is proximity to transmission lines, and that's really based on their experience. We know that most of these large-scale solar projects get built near transmission. That makes a lot of sense. The second was resource-based criteria, and this includes ecosystem characteristics, presence of different species. So that's something that they were looking at as well. And then the third was looking at areas that have been previously disturbed that are outside of that transmission proximity. So they're screening kind of at this coarse filter for this region-wide plan. And then at specific sites, you're going to need to do the site-specific habitat analysis. You're going to need to do the site-specific wildlife analysis later in the process. And that's, we can talk about implementation of this plan. There are more steps here that the BLM, their field offices, are going to be needing to look at and being adequately staffed and resourced to make those decisions to consider the types of impacts you just mentioned.
So it needs to be kind of judged on a more site-specific, case-by-case basis.
Yeah, this is just one step in the process. This is looking at the entire region. What are the big picture screening criteria that we need to have? And then in this individual projects, there needs to be further investigation, analysis to make sure that you have those. And I'd also say that the plan includes a lot of the attention on the acres that are being made available, but the plan also includes programmatic design considerations. And those include having site-specific analysis. Those include having field verification to think about your construction methods, your site design, fencing, all these factors that can influence wildlife migration, habitat connectivity. The plan calls for those analyses to happen at the site-specific level, and that's really important to implement the plan effectively.
This solar plan was released while the state and the Biden administration have also invested heavily into the so-called lithium loop, this process of extracting lithium, processing it, recycling it, building batteries, making sure it all kind of happens in this state. It's two different industries. Can too much happen here at once?
That's a great question. I'm not going to be able to speak to the lithium
Sure.
development side. What I will say is that the Bureau of Land Management, what they're doing here, looking programmatically, making decisions across the entire West, looking at what are the key factors that need to be considered across the board helps those next steps in their planning process. When they're looking at the individual, you know, field office, the individual BLM district office, looking at the individual project level, having this programmatic approach up front helps those subsequent decisions be much more effective and more thoughtful.
You know, there's an argument that BLM or that policymakers should be looking towards more distributive solar, more, you know, community solar. There's an argument, though, that this is much more cost effective. You know, which one should we be looking at? Is it a little bit of both? You know, what is the proper balance here?
I don't think it's an either or. The scale of the climate problem requires a scale of deployment to meet it. And so, you know, taking a pragmatic approach, looking at where are all the opportunities where we can get the clean energy infrastructure we need deployed is crucial. And this is the Bureau of Land Management looking at its authority, looking at the public lands, and figuring out where is that piece of the puzzle going to fit? How can public lands contribute to this overall deployment for the energy infrastructure we need to address climate change? One of the stats that I think is interesting here is that there was a 2020 study from Yale and the Wilderness Society that said at that point, all of the wind, solar, and geothermal deployed in the country, only 5% of it was on public lands. So there was a lot of unrealized potential on these public lands to help meet those climate goals by deploying clean energy infrastructure.
My understanding of the plan also calls for expediting processing. So energy producers who want to build an array, there's a little expedited permitting. Is that part of the process too?
So this is just one piece of the actions that the Department of the Interior, this is just one of many actions the Department of the Interior is taking to address renewable energy deployment on public lands. They also finalized earlier this year a rule about the processing for wind and solar applications. And that's going to be, how does this plan go into action? How do individual offices, when they get those applications, how are they prioritized? How are they addressed? Hopefully quickly, but also in a way that is looking at the ecosystem impacts, that is looking at the community impacts and making sure that those are all taken into consideration.
You know, as we wrap up, let me ask you this. Do you think the BLM made the right call in drafting this Western Solar Plan?
The Bureau of Land Management manages over 200 million surface acres on this multiple use mission. For us to hit our clean electricity goals for the country and states like Nevada, we need to deploy more generating capacity. The Western Solar Plan update is about how are we going to do that at a west-wide programmatic scale.
We'll have to leave it there. Frank Sturgis is a lawyer for the Clean Air Task Force. Frank, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And in a statement, the BLM said this: the updated Western Solar Plan will help build modern, resilient energy infrastructure that creates a strong, clean energy economy and protects our communities from the worsening impacts of climate change. Through extensive planning and collaboration, we're not only protecting our public lands, but also ensuring that permitting for solar projects moves faster and more efficiently, avoiding conflicts and striking the right balance as we advance clean energy and safeguard the environment. Trade groups have also voiced support. In a statement, the Solar Energy Industry Association said they were pleased by the plans. They say, quote, one of the fastest ways to decarbonize our grid is to greenlight well-planned clean energy development on federal lands, and the improvements to this environmental review document will certainly help. As a note, State of Nevada also reached out to NV Energy to get their take, but received no response. However, opponents of the plan say it does put several beloved places in the West at risk. That includes the Great Basin National Park, the Eastern Sierra, Ruby Valley, the Black Rock Desert, Esmeralda County, and the Arizona Strip on the northern side of the Grand Canyon. One of those opponents is Kevin Emmerich. He's the co-founder of Basin and Range Watch. That's a nonprofit dedicated to conserving the deserts of Nevada and California and educating the public about the diversity of life, culture, and history of the ecosystems and wildlands of the desert. Kevin, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Well, it is great to have you here. A couple of questions here. You just heard Frank Sturgis and the excitement you could hear in his voice for these for this plan. Really, it's kind of a plan to allow zoning in the future for potential solar. What did you think about that?
Well, he has an interesting take on it, and I respect his opinion. We feel that the big Western solar plan, it's being deployed too fast. It's considering a lot of acres, like 31 million acres in the entire West. They've added it to 11 Western states. And we feel that it's almost impossible to make a plan like this, and in the amount of time that they did, and evaluate all of the potential impacts that are going to result from it. The plan is a long-term future plan. It's designed for smart planning of solar energy on public land. And it did come out with some encouraging alternatives. For example, they had an alternative five that would have restricted the solar development onto disturbed lands, put it closer to transmission lines, and exclude the solar development on endangered species, habitat, occupied areas with endangered species, on sensitive archaeological sites, adjacent from national parks that would have been moved back a little bit. And it would have protected some of Nevada's communities more. But they selected an alternative that actually promotes a lot more development. And we feel that there are a lot of areas in the state of Nevada that are actually going to be impacted by this.
You talked about archaeological areas, the sensitive environments that could be impacted, and the wildlife. Do you think there's anything out there that could be done to mitigate this potential damage? Like, for instance, like relocating tortoises or reseeding vegetation?
Well, I've been involved as a biologist before I was Basin and Range Watch, and I did field biology for desert tortoise. Relocating tortoises, there have been a lot of advances on moving desert tortoises to another area and monitoring them. It's not completely unsuccessful. There have been good examples of biologists doing it a better way than other examples. But it's not a species that necessarily adapts well to that kind of change. We saw a bad example of this when tortoises were relocated in the Pahrump Valley for the Yellow Pine Solar Project. It was done on a record-breaking drought year. They were moved off the project site, and on the recipient site, there were badgers that were very hungry because of the drought and climate change and preyed and killed on 33 of the individuals. We've also seen examples where desert tortoises are very disoriented and they try to travel very long distances to get back to their original home, and they end up dying of hyperthermia, that's overheating, because the areas are actually fenced off. The mitigation has fallen short so far throughout the West. About 80,000 acres or so approximately of desert tortoise habitat has been developed. Reseeding an area, it's always a noble thing to try to do, but you got to understand here in the desert, both the Mojave and Great Basin, when an area is disturbed by heavy earth-moving equipment, they'll remove sensitive biological soil crusts. They'll destroy desert pavements that are thousands of years old. And they create a real opportunity for invasive weeds to move in. Up in the Great Basin area, they have a real problem with cheatgrass moving in on disturbed areas. Here in the Mojave Desert, we just had Hurricane Hilary a year ago, and a couple of the solar sites that were developed actually had a giant outbreak of invasive grasses. One's called Schismus grass, which colonizes. It's originally from the Mediterranean area. It's questionable to me if we could reseed that and restore it to what it was.
You know, a part of this plan also does something that a lot of people might not know. It eliminates some regulations, such as allowing arrays to be built on slopes. How big of a concern is that to you?
This is a big concern for me, and we have actually, in our comments and in our protest of this plan, are still opposing that. Originally, the BLM made a regulation that solar energy could be developed up to a 5% slope. The industry felt this was too restrictive, And they felt it was for a specific technology that would be concentrated thermal solar, like the Ivanpah towers by Prim. And building those on too steep of a slope would create technological problems. It is possible to build photovoltaic solar panels on slopes. We see pictures where they have covered entire mountains with photovoltaic panels in China. They don't have as much regulation over there. Right. If we increase that to 10%, what we're going to see is a lot of the alluvial slopes. They're sometimes referred to as bajadas. They're basically all the deposits from drainage of large mountains in the Mojave and Great Basin. We're going to see the solar panels go up to the foot of the mountains. From a visual perspective, that's going to be pretty bad. If you're living in a community near one of these projects, that will be visible for miles. From a hydrologic perspective, surface water drainage, we have seen a lot of these areas flooded by intense monsoons, which are getting more intense over climate change. Hurricane Hillary, for example, did some extensive damage to the Silver State South project near Prim, Nevada, where it literally covered a lot of the bases of these solar panels with a concrete-like mud. We believe that that's going to create technological problems, environmental problems, and very bad aesthetic problems.
I want to ask you this question, which Paul also asked of Frank Sturgis. The solar plan was released as the state and the Biden administration have invested heavily into the lithium loop, creating a lithium industry in this state, from mining to refining to creating batteries. There are different views on that as well, that mining can lead to contaminated aquifers, that mining disturbs sacred indigenous territory. Do you think maybe we're trying to do too much in one place and too quickly?
Most definitely. I mean, we have been involved in the Thacker Pass case. We were actually plaintiffs against that project to the Bureau of Land Management. That project could damage the aquifer for 300 years. And so there are new lithium extraction techniques that minimize water use. However, are they the most economical? And many of those are speculative. To create a lithium loop and to potentially develop most of the lithium claims along this big transmission loop for the Green Links that they're talking about will have very devastating impacts to our aquifer. We'll see groundwater withdrawal. We'll see springs drying up. We may actually see pollution of water sources. In the Clayton Valley, Nevada, the aquifer has gone way down, it's lowered because of the lithium extraction. That's really the only area now in the U.S. where it's being extracted very economically. If this expands to a point where we have, you know, five or six major lithium projects all along this big loop of and transmission and solar projects, it's going to have a very big cumulative impact to Nevada's natural resources.
You know, Kevin, I wonder if there's something of a tug of war internally for you. I'm sure you're as worried as anybody about climate change, and solar holds some promise to slow it, but you're also worried about the environment. Is this a struggle for you?
Not as much as you might think, because I'm not against solar energy. Our group never has been. We've gone to the Nevada legislature, been asked to refine some legislation and one of the bills to actually increase the use of rooftop solar, but not just rooftop solar, solar over parking lots, using solar, for example, on abandoned mine sites, which there are quite a few of those in Nevada. And we believe that the potential of this siting of solar is a lot bigger than some of the industry wants to admit. I mean, there's a recent article from PV Magazine where somebody calculated that the United States has 75,000 square miles of rooftops that could be deployed for solar energy. we're going to get arguments from the other side. How practical is that? Can that be hooked up into transmission? Mm-hmm. It's more expensive. It goes on and on and on. But we don't feel that it's being deployed like it could. For example, the country of Vietnam in 2020 deployed 9 gigawatts of rooftop solar onto their grid. I'm just saying that the potential is there, and sure, perhaps in the future the cost can be worked out. But is it worth it to damage so much public land before we can figure all this stuff out? And that's why I'm saying we're moving too fast here.
Okay. That's Kevin Emmerich, co-founder of Basin and Range Watch. Kevin, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.